Okay, we are live on YouTube. Thank you all for joining us. My name is Joshua Gilliland. I'm one of the founding attorneys of the Legal Geeks. With me to discuss the season one finale of Andor, Rick's Road is Thomas Harper, Bethany Blanton, Christine Peake, and Jordan Hubert. That was in order of Zoom appearance and not alphabetical or playing favorites or anything like that. So also, none of our opinions reflect our employers. This is all for fun and mere personal opinions and should not be considered legal advice. Really, if you live in a place with an empire repressing civil rights, that's a very dangerous place to be. That's not the world that we live in, luckily. So with that, let's jump in. Tom, what did you think of this episode?
I thought it was incredible. A really fitting end and a really poignant one. I mean, there are a lot of ways that all of this could have been brought to a head. I thought doing it through the vehicle of the funeral was really, really powerful. I don't know how you get more powerful than doing that. And sort of the framing of the framing of it through the words of the manifesto that Cassian carries with him. It was just a really powerful exhibit on filmmaking and some of the best Star Wars that I think has been put to the screen.
Bethany?
This episode was so emotionally powerful and so cinematically powerful, which I feel like I'm echoing Thomas here. But it had so much of an impact, as much so as my memories of seeing Star Wars on the big screen, seeing Rogue One for the first time. I can't wait for the next season.
Excellent. Christine, your thoughts?
I was riveted the whole time. I also found it very emotionally affecting, in particular, Marva's speeches, the final words that she delivers to Cassian through Brasso was really moving. And then of course her own speech at her own funeral. And then the funeral itself, right? The procession, the music that is involved in the procession, and then how the scene slowly unfolds and the tension builds and builds and builds. I was just really glued to the screen the whole time and couldn't look away for that entire sequence.
Thank you. Jordan, your thoughts?
I thought it was great. I'll echo what everybody else said. It's quite possibly the best Disney era Star Wars to come out. One of the things that I really like about this episode in particular, but the show as a whole, is its use of kind of juxtapositions between, you know, light and darkness in the riot scene, the smoke versus the clear air, and its contrast between loud noises and silence, and its use of silence I thought was fantastic. Also, delivering your own eulogy is a really high level move. Props to Marva for that one.
Yeah, they knocked it out of the park. I think this is Emmy worthy. I think it is the best written, directed, and acted Star Wars ever. And I would not be surprised to see Emmy nominations for actors, something that does not happen all that often. I believe Alec Guinness had an Oscar nomination for his role. I'm not sure if anyone else did. And I'm sure a trivia master could share that, but it's normally special effects. It's not, this was exceptionally written. So that's just mind blowing to see and very inspiring.
Alec Guinness was nominated Best Supporting Actor in 1978, according to Wikipedia.
Okay. Yeah, that's the only acting Oscar that the saga has ever been nominated for.
Because it's Alec Guinness.
You know, what are you gonna do? That's as soon as he was cast, the nomination was in. Like, we don't care what you do. Well, he's gonna be skateboarding with, like, while being chased by a dog. That sounds like a really all-time performance. So it's in.
Yeah, it's rock on. I mean, he was a very versatile actor. So now with that, let's get into the many legal issues that we've identified in this episode. So we begin with bomb making by a civilian, which makes me think of IEDs. And oh, Thomas, any thoughts on that?
This is one of those great scenes. This is if folks didn't make the connection there, this is the son of Salman Pak. So the gentleman who was taken in alongside Bix and then ultimately killed by the Empire after he was tortured with that audio device. And so this is his son with the hologram of his dad sitting there as he puts together a bomb. We haven't seen anything like this in Star Wars before, like the physical, like a physical IED being made. Like, I mean, it's very reminiscent of an improvised explosive device that you might see getting made somewhere on this planet. And the reason I highlighted it, obviously, I think there are laws that go without saying about weapons of mass destruction and a pipe bomb. Let's make the parallel there. A pipe bomb would squarely fit that definition. Folks routinely get prosecuted for that sort of thing. There's at least one individual connected with the building of a pipe bomb that was brought to January 6th, who's facing that kind of charge for this, for that same thing. Reason I highlighted it though is that Wilman, which is his name, Wilman is a civilian. So he's a civilian who has chosen to make this device and then ultimately use it later in the episode. And it brings out a really important aspect of the law surrounding armed conflict, because civilians are generally protected. That's a protected status as a person walking around Ferrix, even with an Imperial presence there. You are presumed to be a civilian unless you are directly participating in hostilities. The moment that he picks up that welder, the moment that he's assembling those parts, like that, just that act of putting the bomb together, even if he doesn't have a blaster, even if he's not, doesn't have a live explosive device on him, that qualifies as directly participating in hostilities. And the trigger is an important one there, because it strips him, at least temporarily, of his protected status as a civilian. He is now a combatant. We're framing this as an armed conflict. He's now a combatant and he can be targeted. And so he loses that protection that he would otherwise enjoy. The fact that he is doing this, presumably in his house, in his garage, I don't know, maybe in his dad's house. You know, the protection that building, that civilian building affords him, that's stripped away as well, because he's brought that activity within those four walls. He probably doesn't realize that. And maybe he does, and he's making the conscious choice saying the Rubicon has been crossed and I'm all in at this point. And I'm going to avenge my dad's death. But I think that there's a difference there that folks might not realize, or they maybe folks think that there's a difference between that act of building and then the act of employing it, throwing the explosive device. And for purposes of like engage, considering him a valid military target, there's no difference. So whether he's building and just connecting wires or winding up and chucking it at Imperial forces, he's DPHing. So that means he's not a civilian. In between those acts, you can regain that civilian status. But those two key moments in time that we see on screen, he's a valid military target.
Thank you. And not at all timely or reflecting reality. We have the issue of holding Bix without bail. And who added that to the outline?
I added it.
Okay. Jordan, can you help us understand that bond issue?
Sure. So normally in at least civilian courts, and Bix, I think, at this point is still squarely in the civilian court world, but Thomas can correct me if I'm wrong. She is arrested and held by the Empire. Normally when you're arrested, you have a bond hearing or a bail hearing, where the court sets conditions of your release. They can be anything from, you know, you have to check in with a court agent to make sure you're sticking around, you're gonna go to your, you know, whatever your next court hearing is, to you have to come give drug and alcohol tests, or you have to wear an ankle monitor so we know where you are, to you have to put up sometimes, you know, $10,000, $20,000, $100,000 in whatever. Oregon is all cash, but other states do property or things like that, to assure that you're going to follow the rules, stay out of trouble, and show up at a hearing. And you get a right to that from various state statutes and the Eighth Amendment. All say you're entitled to, you know, a reasonable amount of bail being posted. So we never see that. Now, it's possible that they said to Bix, well, here's your bail amount. And Bix said, I can't afford that. In which case, the answer is generally sorry, but not sorry. And I have clients like that all the time who, you know, bail was set at $20,000, and they say, well, I have about $20 to my name, and, you know, we go around about that. So that could have happened. The other thing that could have happened is there are a couple of exceptions, at least in Oregon, to when bail is required. One of them is murder, but the other one is treason. So if they're holding Bix on suspicion of treason, then it's possible they just don't have to. It is also entirely possible that the Empire, as a tyrannical government, has done away with that. And if they want to hold you in jail indefinitely, they will hold you in jail indefinitely.
Well done. And yeah, you're at the point where everything can be treason. So that's the fallacy of the tyrannical Empire. That, you know, if you're against the state, you're a traitor, and thus, you know, you have no civil rights. It's the mindset that only the guilty have to fear the police state.
It's all about definitions.
Exactly. Now, go on, Christine.
I was just going to add to what Jordan said, that another problem is that for these last couple of episodes, we see them still holding Bix, even though it doesn't look like she herself has been charged with any crime. We don't ever see her get arraigned or anything like that. That's all just sort of left to the imagination. An arraignment is a court hearing where a person who's been arrested is formally told of the charges against them. They're usually given a copy of whatever the charging document is, if it's a complaint, for example, and given an opportunity to enter a plea. And then if the person is charged with a bailable offense, as Jordan alluded to, the court may set bail if bail hasn't already been set. And states, at least California, has a statute that requires an arraignment within a certain amount of time from arrest. So 48 hours within arrest, not counting weekends and court holidays. So you would not, for example, want to get arrested the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, but there is, you know, some statutory safeguards in place to make sure that people just aren't indefinitely held in pretrial detention. And that's something that looks like it's possibly happening to Bix. The other thought I had along those lines is I wonder if her detention might be more similar to that pretrial detention of a material witness. So I wonder if the federal material witness statute might be something that the Empire has in analogous form, and, you know, that's some kind of basis on which they're continuing to hold her.
Material bait be a reason? Right. She seems to be the backup to his dead mother.
Right, because it's hard to think of a legitimate basis aside from that, what they would be holding her for. And so if they don't have a legitimate basis, yeah, perhaps the real basis is they're just trying to lure Cassie in.
Material witnesses often involve actual proceedings too. There's no proceeding against Cassian at this point, so there's no proceeding to hold her on as a material witness.
Right, and I think that statute provides also for detention if the person, like if the person's statement can be taken in the form of a deposition, I think there may be some basis to seek release. And I mean, here she might say, well, look, you've got my statement. That's kind of what I was thinking the whole time in the last episode is like they have her statement about Cassian. Like she doesn't have any more information to give them that would really be helpful, it seems, than what she's already done. So why are they continuing to hold her? But bait could be why they're continuing to hold her.
You have my very, very coerced statement. So
right.
Let me go.
Perhaps they're thinking, well, okay, we know we got this under torture, so it's not. So we'd like the opportunity to depose her properly and under conditions that aren't torture. And so then we'd like to keep her detained for that reason.
Yeah, that's not good faith. But since they did open the door with torture, with dying children, we're kind of beyond them playing by any sort of rules. So yeah, they just not good people. So let's talk about Spellhouse and the fact that the attack takes place, all those guys are slaughtered, and there is no prisoners. And Deidre is the only one going like, guys, we need prisoners. Because when you think about it, back to A New Hope, all those guys on the Tent of Four should have known where Yavin 4 was. Like, maybe not kill everyone. Maybe keep the captain alive, because they clearly had been there.
So. Yeah, so I dropped this in here, and I'm really interested to hear Bethany's take on this. This, particularly because this was a really significant opportunity for the Empire. They had not caught this sort of coordinated attack before. And I think you can kind of see the Dedra's inevitable frustration with it. It took me two times watching this to kind of catch this bit though. When I initially watched it, they speak about prisoners and it's like not today, and it's like, oh, okay, well, it was just like a really like brutal counterattack, like they just, you know, spared no expense with the blaster bolts. But when the concern is raised about no prisoners, I noticed that there's this comment that Partagaz makes that this is about cleansing the taste of Aldani from the Emperor's mouth. And so the subtext there is that there was some intentional brutality that they could have taken prisoners. That might have been the tactically smart thing to do, but they weren't going to because of this retribution that needed to happen. And so we don't know what happened. We'll never know what happened sort of specifically in that that attack, because it obviously didn't happen on screen. We can presume that maybe there were some fighters from the rebel side that were injured. They're put out of combat basically and no longer able to fight, and they were killed in the process. If the Empire is killing folks or you know, even capturing folks and executing them, all that's flatly outlawed under the law of war. Once somebody is injured and they're sort of out of the fight, so to speak, the French term is hors de combat, they're done. And that was one of the core components of the original Geneva Convention, the first Geneva Convention in the 1800s. It was for the protection and amelioration of suffering of sick and wounded on the battlefield. And this idea that historically speaking, you're put to the sword, that prisoners and those out of combat were just chips on the table, so to speak. and were routinely slaughtered needlessly, or made to suffer needlessly. So to the extent that the Empire did something like that, and I think that this is like the beautiful, a beautiful example of this show treating the audience like an adult. Like, they don't need to say, hey, we captured these guys and Anto Krieger begged for his life and we killed him. That's all there. You just have to, like, it's awesome to have something where you can watch again and pick up on stuff like that. And I may not be right. That may not be the intent, but that's the art of this show. Bethany, I'd be curious to hear sort of your take on Spellhouse.
Yeah, throughout the episode, I think we see not just hints, but outright proof that, especially as viewers knowing what happens with the Rebel Alliance, what happens with Mon Mothma, etc., we're seeing a failure in the Empire's approach to spycraft. Like, you have the organization that is supposed to be valuing obtaining information and acting on information, willfully throwing away information chances to follow what the Emperor is saying. So from like a military command perspective, that's a commander in chief, if you will, if you can see the Emperor in that way, overreaching to such a degree that he or his philosophy is micromanaging stuff that the actual specialists and subject matter experts like Dedra are saying, hey, this is a bad idea. Like, we need this information. We need to keep pulling these threads. And the Empire is not doing that. The ISB as a whole isn't doing that, even when they have talented officers trying to enact what their specialty code is, if you will. And you see this in some ways, you see it again with the Imperial agents talking about how they've placed snipers everywhere. And Dedra's just like, what are, no snipers. Do I have to say this again? Don't make me say it again. You better make this clear. And so she's being frustrated, and other ISB agents probably are also being frustrated, as well as their leadership is saying, well, you know, we have to essentially soothe the Emperor in the way that we act. And that's a terrible way of conducting either military business or spycraft. So you don't want those things to be emotional and wiping out a bunch of people on top of being horrific is also counterproductive. You're also teaching people to not give information, because now if you're a rebel and you know what is happening to rebels who are caught, there's no incentive to give information because you know you're just going to get killed. So they're burning all of their leads. That's not an effective way of carrying out business, and it's definitely fascistic in nature, and winds up being very counterproductive in the long run. What the ISB should be prioritizing are people who are getting results from an information perspective, since they're in the business of information. What they should be prioritizing is the training of their undercover agents like Korv, so that they're not sneaking around cartoon style and being found out. Because we see that Korv, someone who's supposedly like the undercover ISB agent in the episode, someone who's supposedly been trained in this, has been found out and then gets stabbed by Cinta. So someone with a high level of training should be capable of not being discovered by a rebel amateur. So not to like say that Cinta is not talented, clearly she is. However, with the resources that the ISB has, their agents should be more talented, and the talented, experienced agents who are proving themselves in the field, like Dedra, should be delegated down to more and listened to, because they're the ones in the field, they're the ones who have a sense of what's going on. So it's very interesting to see the Empire's own policies really like crumbling in on itself even this early in the timeline.
Well, it one highlights thing... oh, go on, Jordan.
Sorry, I was just gonna say one thing that keeps coming back to me as I watch this show and as we do these podcasts is it gives a whole new connotation to Leia's line in A New Hope about the more you tighten your grip, the more star systems will slip through your fingers.
Yeah, and on top of that, it highlights, you know, historical examples. Now, there's the joke about the Battle of Normandy, where no one on the German side wanted to wake up Der Führer. And it's like, good job. I'm glad you were terrified and that inept, because it helped the invasion be successful. Also, if you're going to be on a stakeout, don't hang out in the same coffee shop. Cinta was smart with, I'm going to get a job as the barista here. And that way she could, you know, have a cover that makes sense for being there, as opposed to, I'm just going to sit here with binoculars drinking my spotchka all day long. And that's not at all concerning or strange. So
yeah, his clothes were perfectly clean. He would like walk around looking everywhere, obviously. That's kind of why I mentioned like the almost cartoonish, like sneaking around is, I mean, it wasn't that bad, but his cover was very poor. Anyone like untrained could have spotted him because of how much he stood out in the environment. He didn't bother to get a job. He didn't bother to truly look like a local. Even when he and Dedra were both dressed up, they both stood out like sore thumbs. And for her, that kind of makes sense because she may not be trained in being undercover, but that should be his responsibility to make sure that any visiting ISB higher ranking officers are like spun up on the local culture and population well enough to be able to fit in and be effective. And that's just not happening.
It's the old Mad Magazine spy versus spy. You know, it's like he's in the black outfit with the hat. And it's just like, you're clearly ISB, dude. Like, we know you're here. Oh, look, the woman who's immaculate wearing a robe. Okay, yeah, we know what she's doing as well. So just not the bad guys are a bit emboldened. So let's talk about prison breaks. And this show doesn't have to explain everything to us, that Cassian uses the funeral as a reason to, as cover for getting Bix out. And that's awesome. But it raises the issue we've talked about before of liability for prison breaks. If you participate in a prison break, in aiding an escaping prisoner, that's a crime. So now, does that mean Cassian and Brasso are in a conspiracy to liberate Bix? Yeah.
Yes, it does.
Yeah, they're the good guys. Because Cassian's mom would have wanted it that way. So like they're the good guys. Any other comments on this? No. Okay. Nice and quick to highlight. All right. Is Luthen guilty of attempted murder of Cassian? And Jordan, did you add that?
It did.
Okay.
Because I think it's an interesting subplot, and it takes us kind of full circle with Luthien and Cassian's story from the beginning, where he goes in to recruit him for this job, to the end where he's, why is something banging on my door? Sorry about that. To the end where he's, you know, plotting to kill Cassian to keep his secret identity secret. Now, I don't know if this plotting of his rises quite to the level of an attempted crime. You can certainly attempt crimes by attempting basically having a plan and then taking a substantial step, is what I guess the term of art would be, toward completing that plan. Now, Luthien certainly has a plan. He shows up, presumably with the intent to kill Cassian, which, taking, you know, that physical actual step to showing up can certainly be the legal substantial step. Though I don't know, and what we don't know, and maybe we'll see in season two, is whether or not that was really, you know, Luthien's dedicated intent there, or was it, I'm going to find him, I'm going to talk to him, if he says the wrong thing, I'm going to kill him, or was it, I'm going to find him and I'm going to shoot first, because we got to clean this up. So, I mean, if his intent was to go find Cassian and shoot him, the going very well could be construed as that substantial step. Josh, you look thoughtful.
He has two associates out there who've taken affirmative steps. So I think there is a conspiracy to kill Cassian. And I think Cinta has and Vel have taken those steps. Now, no one's aimed a weapon at him, but I think deploying agents could be an overt act. And Christine, I saw you nodding along. Do you?
I agree, Josh. And I would add Clea to that mix as well. Thinking back to episode 7, where she has that conversation with Vel. And, you know, it's not stated at any point that Luthien told Clea to tell Vel that we have a loose end and we can't have him walking around with Luthien in his head. But I feel like that's implied. Especially when Vel says, oh, you mean kill him? And Clea says, well, that's what revolution looks like. So, I mean, I think that's possibly also in the overt act category, at least behind the scenes. And although I do see kind of what Jordan is saying with the intent, like, I think he definitely has the intent through most of that episode up until the very last moment where maybe you think, well, he's possibly reconsidering his plan here when he actually sees Cassian in person.
Or listens to his mom, because his mom validates, you know, what Luthien has been after. Jordan, what's your thoughts on the fact that they actually travel star systems to get to Fenix? Is that an overt act in your mind, or you think it has to be aiming the? Okay.
Yeah. No. I think traveling to Fenix is definitely the overt act, the substantial step to do it, if that's what Luthien wants to do. And it's possible that's exactly what he wants to do. And seeing Marva's speech kind of gives him more of the background of who Cassian is and how he was brought up and where his mindset probably is. Because, I mean, the other thing to remember is before that speech, we don't really know what Luthien knows about Cassian other than he's a friend of Bix. He doesn't like the Empire. He stole this piece of tech and he helped with the Aldani thing and then turned tail. So it's possible that hearing Marva's speech gives that whole complete picture.
Well, early on in the show, it is clear that Luthien has been spying on Cassian and has learned as much as he can about Cassian because, like, Cassian is targeted for recruitment. I kind of wonder if not just Marva's speech, but what happened with essentially the massacre that Luthien was aware of and let happen and was clearly feeling some level of guilt over when he spoke with Saw Gerrera about it. I wonder if that's starting, like, if all of these things are adding up for Luthien and he's starting to reconsider some of his approaches, or if he simply sees how much Cassian has changed between the time they left Ferrix and now they're all back on Ferrix again, but so much has changed for all of them as people.
And not killing Cassian is penance for letting Krieger die.
Yeah, or just seeing how much Cassian has changed, or a combination of, like, all of these factors.
It's odd that he's on Ferrix, that he travels there, because of all the people on the Aldani team, I think Cinta is probably the most adept and capable, like probably the most ruthless of all of them. It doesn't make sense to me that Luthen would think I need to go there as a backstop in case she fails. Maybe, but he's got other folks like Vel that can fill that role for him. And so I think his traveling there, you could sort of play devil's advocate and hold out as equal proof that, you know, that's a physical act of him moving to back out of the conspiracy and try to undo things. It's just that the riot and all that unexpected stuff happens in the middle. Cinta, for her part, I mean, she's setting up a firing position. I mean, that's a scope that she has in the window there. She is exactly where she wants to be. Like, Vel has to pull her out and say, like, hey, like, stop for a second from your, you know, setup of your assassination here, and let's talk. So it's clear that she is taking the step forward, but Luthen, as always, is a little more complicated.
Yeah, and it works extremely well from everything about this series. They just did a magnificent job on having complex, dynamic characters.
Luthen also, at least to my memory, has always seemed a bit reluctant when he's talking about killing Cassian. He's always, you know, if we have to, or, well, let's just find him, kind of hedging on it. So it'd be interesting to see in season two what fallout he gets from Vel and Cinta and the rest for bringing Cassian on board or back on board.
Yeah, they have to be able to go to the next level for the rebellion, because if they're in the let's kill anyone who can help us stage, they're not going to get far. That they'll keep doing hit and run missions, but you need to be able to have a self-sustaining force. And if you kill the people who are helping you, that's bad for morale and recruiting. So there are problems with that. However, let's pivot back to Coruscant and the fact that you have the ISBs, you know, spying on civilians. RCIA is not supposed to spy on US citizens in the United States. That's the FBI's job. There's probably those who are going to argue conspiracies and other crazy stuff. And not that there isn't evidence to support some of those crazy things. But who added the ISB spawning on Mon?
So I led off with that. The thing that came to mind for me was the Pentagon Talon program, this database, the threat and local observation notice. The military is nothing if not like really creative with its acronyms, but somewhere somebody put that on their evaluation report and got like some brownie points for coming up with that name. But it was sort of this database, threat tracking database, that was set up in the wake of 9/11. It was using things like the Patriot Act, which we've talked about in the context of this series, and these sort of broader powers granted to the executive branch and the military to combat terrorism and national security threats. And the database was originally designed to track or to identify and track terroristic threats, the overseas type threats that may be operating domestically. What it ended up getting used for, at least in part, was tracking U.S. citizens and toward, we'll call it the meat of the Iraq War, so 2005 to 2006 or so. The Pentagon was tracking anti-war protesters, both organizations and individuals who were sort of actively and loudly protesting against our involvement in Iraq. And they were finding themselves in this database, or at least the ACLU uncovered this and sued the Pentagon over it. And the Pentagon sunsetted the program in 2007, their claim was that, hey, this is just not, we're not getting the juice, isn't worth the squeeze. This database isn't getting us what we need. In reality, in at least one FOIA that came out of it, they're quoted as, or their officials that are quoted as saying, like, this is a bad look for us. Like, but in all of it, through all of it, the Pentagon steadfastly maintained that all of it was lawful. And the ACLU obviously, like, seriously disagreed with that. But the core issue was that this sort of raft of legislation to combat terrorism and this loosening of regulation and rules set conditions for that term national security to be used almost carte blanche to justify a lot of activities that ran roughshod over Americans' rights to privacy and things like that, and really sort of without a lot of Americans knowing, if not for the work of ACLU and some other organizations, you know, your rights were being eroded without you realizing it. And in dangerous ways in some cases. I mean, I don't know of any cases where somebody was arrested because they appeared in Talon, but at the same time, that's sort of a stepping stone and a domino that could fall. So in the context here, Mon Mothma knows that her driver is spying on her. She's like as certain as you can be. That interaction in the car, and I think we're going to touch on another issue with it, is a setup, right? Like, she knows she's being listened to, and that's a tactical conversation that she's having, much to Perrin's amazement. He has no idea about any of this. But that act of spying, when placed against what the Empire is doing, both in the wake of the Clone Wars and in the wake of Aldani, this sort of similar, like, broadening of the Emperor's powers to go after rebellion and terrorism, it very much echoes post 9/11 America, like the 2000s, 2001 to 2010. And it wouldn't surprise me at all that, you know, if the ISB had some sort of similar database of specifically politicians that they were keeping an eye on. And that's a recurring theme with Mon, that she's under the thumb of the ISB here. But I raise all this because they would point to the fact that it's perfectly legal. Whatever rights that you had, however fundamental those are, they'll use that national security rationale to ratchet up the importance of this, of the curtailing of that right. It's for the greater good, so to speak. And that's what that's the crosshairs that Mon is caught in between here.
Good analysis. And
so,
go on.
I'll just throw in, Thomas, since you mentioned that you weren't aware of anybody being arrested because of information in the Talon database, it reminded me of an issue that the kind of local criminal defense bar in Oregon was working on. About getting access to some of these police and FBI databases, because while nobody's, at least not that I know of either, has been arrested because of information directly in them, the police are using information obtained from those databases to derive other information, which is then used to arrest people. So it's, you know, one step removed. So we, the defense attorneys, never get the actual information that was used to get the information that was used to arrest somebody, which makes it near impossible to challenge whether or not it was lawfully gathered.
Yeah, and that warrantless, I mean, that was a core issue of the ACLU's lawsuit. That's a great point, Jordan. The warrantless collection of that information, information that you would otherwise, in many cases, have an expectation of privacy over, cell phone records, conversations over the phone, that sort of thing. Ordinarily, the government has to get a warrant to do those things, and they weren't. And that the sort of golden ticket, Willy Wonka style, was that those national security laws.
Christine, anything to add on this?
I do. It would be interesting to see as well, because another risk to this besides all of the concerns that have been eloquently spoken to here is when you're applying for government jobs, you often have to fill out extensive amounts of paperwork. And some of the questions that you might get asked would be, or if you like, you're trying to join the military or anything like that, you're asked like what kind of tattoos you've had, if you have ever had any affiliation with extremist organizations. There's a variety of types of questions that you can be asked if you have an official job or a government job. And so if the government is putting organizations or individuals on watch lists unnecessarily, that could be used against them in the future. Like if you were a part of an organization that was anti-war, and in 2003, the Pentagon labeled that organization as being a credible threat, which did happen with Project Talon, then, you know, is that you might have to speak to that, and that could be something that could be used against you if it's like you shouldn't be or allowed to join the military, for example, if you have valid or validated connections with extremist groups, right? Like that's concerning, that should be looked into, that should be resolved before being allowed to move further in a recruitment process. But if we can't trust what organizations are deemed as extremist or problematic or a credible threat, then that could be an issue. Like, I don't personally know of any examples of this, but it's something that I would be concerned about if I were trying to obtain a government job. And then secondarily, from an intelligence perspective, it's very interesting that, again, the empire as a whole and even the ISB, many individuals within the ISB aren't taking into the fact that when it is known that you have such a massive spying organization and efforts across the galaxy, you have to think, especially in the wake of Spellhouse, that people who are organizing against you are going to be intentionally feeding you bad information. And that doesn't seem to be something that the ISB is talking about. So Mon Mothma is masterfully using this against the Empire and against the ISB. And given that the ISB is aware of coordinated rebellious activity, they should be concerned about intelligence, counterintelligence efforts, but they seem very, very arrogant about their abilities.
Well, it's also helpful that her husband has a gambling problem. So being able to leverage that, which raises the issue of how is she, did she slander him? Did she throw him under the bus? I mean, sure, truth is a defense that if he does have a gambling problem, but she's casting innuendo over him of that money's missing and I think it's you. She doesn't say it's you. It's I think it's you. And I think you're lying to me, in order to throw the Bevan and company off her trail in case they start looking at her accounts. It's definitely problematic from a marriage perspective. On I don't know how you work that out in couples therapy, but it's definitely not a good thing. So, but again, masterful scene.
Well, and it's not necessarily clear to me that it was even true that she had heard that he'd been doing that recently, right? Because as Thomas said, the whole thing seems like a setup, right? She knows that the conversation is being listened to by the ISB person. And it's tempting to think that, you know, given how vehemently he denies it, it doesn't seem like it seems like something she may have just done for the purpose of setting him up, throwing him under the bus. So I don't know that truth would be a defense on any level, right? Just to the accusation of the gambling itself, or to the, this is why the money is missing.
Yeah. Well, and
this is one of those things though, that, I mean, if they can prove that she knew it was a lie, they can then probably also prove that she's funneling money toward the rebellion, and suddenly slander becomes the least of her problems.
Right.
Yeah, and this isn't a go-to. It's a use it once excuse, and then she's got to figure out better banking strategy for her rebellious activities so she doesn't get caught. But that's an excuse you can only use once. It's the get out of jail free card, but that's the only time it can be used. So unless the Imperials are really lazy and just go like, well, you know, her husband does have a gambling problem. If they're that obtuse.
There are no life signs aboard this escape pod.
Yeah, like that's.
It is, as a quick aside, it is worth noting that you can defame your spouse. That's not like protected speech because you're married. The rights that I remind my wife of that every time she accuses me of being a Star Trek fan, and I say, you know what, I'll see you in court. Just kidding,
you can like both.
It's okay
to like both.
I do, and she reminds me of that as well, and that my suit would be hopeless.
Yeah, it's like reading both Marvel and DC and maybe occasion IDW. Ooh, like it's okay to like multiple things.
I know.
You would also have to prove damages, Thomas, and I'd be interested to know what your damages are for being a Star Trek fan.
I was given a phaser as a Christmas gift instead of a lightsaber.
This man is a fraud.
Or the emotional damage memes going around.
Yes.
Oi. All right. Let's talk about Marva's eulogy. It's possible in a will you can defame someone and cause liability for an estate. Marva uses death as a shield to encourage people to fight these bastards, fight the Empire. And all those 30,000-40,000 grieving people decide to go, yeah, she's right, I'm in, because there's 40,000 of us and what, like 200 Imperials on Ferrix. So let the games begin. What liability would her estate have for that? And I find it perplexing because she encourages people to fight the Empire. There's no innuendo. It's clear I would get up early every morning and fight them. And she encourages everyone there to fight them. From an insurrectionist point of view, that sounds like a pretty clear connection.
There's not a First Amendment claim because you're inciting violence.
Correct. And you know, how do you can't prosecute an estate, but you could sure as sue it for damages that took place because of that riot. Now, granted, that raises the issue, does the estate have anything worthwhile? Or are you just going to do it for the sake of a shot across the bow to be vindictive? But I find that a fascinating question, because she incited violence.
You know, we know the Empire is never vindictive.
No, Spellhouse highlights that. So it's we know what they're after. So anyone want to build upon that? Hearing none, let's go to the issue of B2 Emo, who gets kicked over. He's broadcasting Marva's eulogy. And the Imperial over walks over and kicks the little guy over. We don't have in the United States, in any state, cruelty to machines. You can have destruction of property, but kicking over the droid raises this cruelty to droids issue that I think you could draw an analogy to cruelty to animals. And by way of comparison, California Penal Code Section 597 states, anyone who intentionally maims, tortures, wounds, or kills an animal is guilty of a crime punishable by imprisonment in a California state prison, a fine of $20,000 or both, or up to 1 year in a county jail. Now, think of it like going over and kicking a golden retriever. Okay, maybe he's going to argue sovereign immunity, and because he's working for, you know, the government, so therefore, you know, he's fine from that perspective. But I do think it's an interesting question of, can you be cruel to a droid?
So, Josh, I think this is at least even more of an interesting comparison. I was reading an interview with Diego Luna about B2Emo, because I was trying to figure out who his voice actor was, and the interview popped up. Apparently the conception of him was as the Andor family dog.
Mm-hmm.
So animal abuse is an apt analogy. And I think, although we've never really seen any evidence of it, in a society where you have sentient or at least semi-sentient machines, you're going to have laws that protect them.
I would hope, because if not, why are you giving them feelings?
Yeah. Well, and it's
arming them. IG-88, battle droids, all the various examples of armed droids.
And making them aware of the conceptualization of torture, death, pain, like an oil bath, feeling good. So it's if you're going to have all of these types of emotions, I would argue that they shouldn't have those types of emotions, or that they shouldn't be built with such concepts if they're not supposed to understand or like feel that themselves. If they don't have a right to like be at least treated as animals. In Jabba the Hutt's palace, we see a lot of mistreatment of both people and droids being tortured in the Star Wars universe. And so I also kind of would take that as, here's a notorious crime lord who will throw people to his pet Sarlacc to be eaten. And he's also abusing and torturing droids. And so I kind of take that as, hopefully there is some type of legislation, because there's definitely norms that suggest that you should be treating droids well, you know.
Maybe, but I remember the Rebels were also all too willing to give Luke a new astromech unit because R2 was old, kind of run down.
Just retiring him
to a farm.
True. repurposing him to this special bin over here, this special other droid duty we need you for. Yeah, I don't know. This is like the most egregious crime to me that we see depicted anywhere in Star Wars. Kicking over, we see that B is clearly not operating at the same level. He's like, you know, the cell phone that you've had for like 8 or 9 years that barely holds a charge, but that has all your favorite pictures on it. You've got this special bond. It's been with you through a lot, moves and big life events and stuff, and then somebody goes and kicks it, and you know, they're sort of kicking a piece of you with it. And if ever there was a time that I was going to get up and yell at the TV, it was that moment when that like blasted officer got up and abused him in the way. So quite frankly, I don't care if there's a law, is or isn't a law in the books about droid abuse. we'd be doing an ex post facto law and retroactively applying it and then creating this law and then applying it to this officer to launch him into the nearest sun.
it's also a good way to ensure a riot, because the next response could have been everyone yelling "get him."
Nobody puts B in a corner.
Yeah, it's like it's like shooting a golden retriever. Like, why would you do that on TV? Just saying, not ever, but like, do it in a very public way that ensures the room will turn against you in a very, very violent manner.
Right. Especially after Marva's moving speech. You really, audience members not feeling too sorry for the guy who gets kicked after that.
No. We then have, first off, I think we're going to see a lot of cosplayers in the band uniforms and in understanding the difference between the colors, because the red ones didn't carry an instrument, so it was like yellow and orange, and trying to figure out what the differences were in the instruments, if the colors actually matter. But I do think we'll see lots of cosplayers in the future for that. And then we get full on, let's fight the Empire. We have the IED get thrown. The assailant is identified as Son of Pack, because good way to radicalize someone is to hang your dad. Like, that's making an IED make sense after that. On top of that, so the fight happens with riot gear where the Imperials can actually see out of. So that's, I guess, a nice perk if you're on the Imperial side for the riot gear. But there's the moment when Deidre enters the fray and she gets a brick to the head or rock to the head and goes down. And then the crowd, you have the highest ranking person there who's a clear target in the fray, and people start kicking her and she's saved by her stalker. And that's just, two wrongs don't make a right. The fact that we were seeing mob justice take place is not good, because the good guys shouldn't just be stomping on people. But it does raise interesting questions about who was right. It was also refreshing to see, compared to Attack of the Clones, Padme falls off an aircraft and says, "I'm fine," and doesn't bat an eye. Deidre's shaking, which is the normal reaction after something that terrifying happening to a person. So I actually, this ground level realism is very refreshing to see, because it we're not cheering for the Empire, but it makes them look more real.
They've definitely stripped a lot of the plot armor out of this one. And I loved the contrast between Deirdre and Cyril when they're in whatever storehouse or whatever, and he's just dead ice calm and she is shaking and thrown, and he's just like, "Oh, hi, my name's Cyril, remember?"
Why wouldn't I dive into the middle of this mix after traveling all the way to Ferrix from Coruscant, knowing that you would be here to save you?
She has to have a concussion. God knows if there's any broken ribs or bruised ribs or other injuries. That's a rough afternoon. But she was firing into the crowd indiscriminately. So it just...
Well, yeah, she knew that she was in a mob that went from just like unrestful to deadly violent. Like, she knew that she was on the path to a really gruesome death. And she's clearly not a field officer. So again, like that's the Imperials who are present there and the ISB members who are there should be managing this situation, and they don't. They kick over the droid, which is going to incite violence, if only because they're cutting off Marva's really moving speech. And then they don't have enough officers present, and they're not keeping their higher ranking officers safe, essentially. They're non-field personnel. So they're messing up on multiple ends, whereas Cyril at least has a background of managing somewhat violent situations from his corporate police security days. So
when Cyril was in a similar position, when he was being held hostage, he was the one that was experiencing the level of fear that she was probably experiencing when she kept trying to get back up and then getting stomped back down repeatedly.
Yeah, there's a lot going on. It's like Ferrix is where you go to destroy your career. And part of it is both Cyril and Deidre were overly confident in their abilities. And they do mirror each other quite nicely with getting in way over their head. Don't know how Deidre is going to talk her way out of this situation, because the after action report will not look kindly upon her. So there is that factor, that the HR meeting will not be a fun one for her. And how many Imperials get killed in this? You know, and it'd be weird. It's not like the Imperials are going to abandon Ferrix. So is the next step firebombing? Like, do they just, I mean, how do you deal with that? Do you just write off the planet and go, we need to make an example of them, so hit them, all of them, because we think they're all guilty now because 40,000 people showed up for Marva's funeral, and we're going to make them all examples. So there isn't a good scenario here, unless they all evacuate.
I could see the Imperials just being like, this seems like a great planet to strip mine.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's not like the Afghanistan of the galaxy. So it's not like the Soviet Union pulling out, going like, we lost a lot of guys here, we're calling it quits. And then the Soviet Union collapses years later. Like, that's not the cause and effect here. This is a different situation. And there can be airstrikes in retaliation where they go, we're done. But they can't let them go on existing after an event like that. Because it can embolden others.
It was just an interesting end cap to this theme that we've seen since the beginning of the season, where the Empire is involved in an area or surges troops in an area relatively recently. They make no effort whatsoever to really understand the culture with which they're immersed in, and in fact treat it with this sort of arm's length disgust, if you will, and in so doing set themselves up for failure. I mean, set themselves up for missed intelligence gathering opportunities or threat assessments, just a whole range of things. It happened on Aldani. It happened in spades here. There's the line, the whole buildup to the funeral, like the Imperials seem fixated on this annoyance that they had to change their typical denial of the right to assemble, or the denial of the right to assemble on Rick's Road for this funeral. They cast, or there's this comment about the daughters of Ferrix as this social club, And it's all clearly more than that. The funeral is all like there's all this is playing out in front of their eyes. And if it weren't, Jordan, as you said, for that tightening of the grip without any real like concern for any tactical sensibility, this idea that I'm trying to think of the exact quote from the manifesto, but like tyranny requires sort of this constant effort. It doesn't mean that it's tailored effort. It doesn't mean that it's a scalpel. And this is another instance of the umpire using a sledgehammer. And that's what gets deployed in response. They come in hard to Ferrix and establish themselves as this domineering presence. And then the moment that things go even slightly belly up, it's guns out. And as an occupying force, they go immediately to the high end of the scale in firing into the crowd indiscriminately. And there's no real thought to any of it to on the Imperial side. So it's a great setup. And this is like an episode that didn't end in sort of your classical cliffhanger like you might see in a series, but the seeds are all there. I mean, this being the last act that we see on Ferrix, I think is going to play very, very significantly in season two.
Agreed. It was just so well done. Just so well done. Now, one of the recurring motifs in Star Wars is the hero moment of deciding, hey, something wrong happened and I'm going to do something right. It's Han going back at the Battle of Yavin. It's the Mandalorian deciding to go save Grogu twice. And that's a Star Wars moment. This show is a little less overt. You know, going back to get Bix is a Star Wars moment, but it wasn't dramatically set up. It was subtle in approach, or one way out Star Wars moment with Kino knows he's not going to be able to swim to shore. The show is just, it's different, it's brilliant, and I do agree it's some of the best Star Wars that's ever been made. So to go through closing thoughts, Thomas, any thoughts?
I spent this entire episode holding this in. There's a Y-wing in this episode. It is parked in the foreground in the shipyard. You see it as Cassian is walking off after their ship that is outfitted, probably with the engine nacelles of that Y-wing, takes off. What more could I ask for to end cap this series? This is my favorite Star Wars that's been put to the small screen. That's not deriding any other Star Wars at all. I've loved all of it, but I think this just hit every chord that I wanted in a series. It's there's always going to be a place for the sort of fantasy Star Wars that's out there, you know, the Slave One getting pulled into the Rancor pit, or you know, Wookiees in battle, that sort of thing. This is like realistic Star Wars at its very finest. It doesn't have to be all of Star Wars, but it fits beautifully this nice niche that I think was sorely needed, that Rogue One sort of opened the door to and exposed the fandom to what this could look like. And I think it's an awesome counterbalance to some of the other programming. And my only lament is it's going to be like a year and a half. I don't know how long until season two. It's, you know, if only we had more content coming down the pipeline to yes. Satiate me.
We had three live action Star Wars shows this year, so there's zero room.
Not enough.
Zero room for complaining. Christine, your thoughts?
I have to echo everything Thomas said. I was really, as I said earlier, riveted by the entire episode and by the series, at least season one, as a whole. And I'm looking forward to see what happens in season two, and disappointed that there is going to be a bit of a wait for that. But yeah, I've Really thoroughly enjoyed the series. Again, that doesn't mean that I didn't enjoy the other live action Star Wars that's come out recently, but yeah, I think this finale was a great way to wrap up season one, and I can't wait to see what happens in season two.
Jordan.
I also thought this was great. I also thought it was some of the best live action Star Wars, if not the best live action Star Wars since the original trilogy. I love that, like Thomas was saying, that we really explored this corner of the Star Wars universe. We did the entire show with no Jedi. We did the entire show with no Skywalkers. And it worked really, really, really well. And I look forward to Ahsoka. I look forward to the return of kind of the Force and the Jedi. And God knows I love lightsaber battles, perhaps more than I should. And I will be happy when those things come back. But this show was amazing. It was so good. And for reasons that I think really resonated in the original idea of Star Wars, the rebellion against the Empire and the fight against tyranny and those things that at least part of which I think made those movies timeless are very much front and center here. And it's an area that they haven't done much in before, and a part of the Star Wars universe they haven't played around in much before. And I hope we get more of it.
Bethany.
Oh man, I have to agree with everyone here. This is kind of, I didn't expect this to be essentially my favorite Star Wars, especially because I do love the Jedi, despite some of their problematic issues. But it's seeing the everyday person make such a massive difference. Like we see where Mon Mothma, where Cassian, where Luthen, where all of these characters come from and where they're going. Like we get to see Cassian going from someone who's really a selfish liar without that many big like dreams of making a difference or anything from the beginning of the show all the way to the end of the show where he's willing to make the sacrifices. These are not like clone troopers that have been bred since birth for warfare and tactics and battle strategy. These are not Jedi who've been trained since younglings in the art of war and peacekeeping and negotiating and lightsaber fighting. You know, Mon Mothma's comparatively, like she's a senator, she has a position of power, but she's considered more of a nuisance, more of a minor senator. And these are all people that have decided to make a difference. And man, what a difference they make in the long run. And that's so much more appealing in some ways and so much more appealing to the heart, I guess, than, you know, comparing oneself to a Jedi master or a clone trooper, or even a Mandalorian with like someone who has years, maybe even decades of experience doing what they're doing. So these are characters that any person watching can identify with and can see how just the choices of these individuals make such a massive difference.
Well said. Yeah, this is a show that should get Emmy nominations. And that's my sincere hope that the quality of the writing and directing and acting is rewarded for the outstanding effort that they did in putting this together. And with that, we have finished the marathon that started with She-Hulk that then overlapped with Lower Decks and into Andor. So now we'll be able to get to a regular schedule for podcasting. And But thank you all who participated with us on this journey, and we look forward to tomorrow. But with that, everyone, wherever you are, stay safe, stay healthy, and stay geeky.